Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.
Greetings to all of you listening around the world and a warm welcome as we bring you another edition of the Answers for the Family radio show. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and I'm glad to be back in studio with my co-host, Dr. Matt Polacek. Now, for those of you who are new to the show, Matt is a nationally recognized expert spokesperson on mental health and substance use disorder issues. He utilizes his experience and expertise to lead the Betty Ford Center's outpatient services as its director.
Well, it's great to be back here with you, Alan. I haven't seen you in a while. And those of you listening out there, we are celebrating Alan's birthday. He's 30 years old today, I think. And for those of you listeners who only know Alan from this show, Alan is an international detective and president of West Shield Adolescent Services, a known leader in crisis intervention and therapeutic transportation. Now, if you're a regular listener, thanks so much for joining us once again. And if this is your first time, please make yourself comfortable as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, each week this show is going to address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more.
And we'll continue to bring you top professionals in many of the helping fields and dynamic authors who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us. Well, Matt, it's glad to be back, and I think we've got a very interesting topic today. This topic is just telepsychiatry. So, and who would have thought 20 years ago that we would be having this topic or be talking about it in the manner in which we're doing? Now, this is something that brings high-quality mental health care to people in rural areas. And one of our questions I think we'll be asking our guests is, can we expect to see more of this in highly populated areas as well? Now, to talk about this, our guests today are Jonathan Evans and Dr. Liberty Eberle. Jonathan is president and CEO and founding partner of Invotel and has been employed in the behavioral health care field for over 30 years. His career began at Hammett Institute for Behavioral Health, and where he was initially employed in the emergency department providing initial evaluations for patients in the emergency room. And he was heading up multiple departments at that location before his departure. Now, Jonathan left Hammett IBH in 1993 to become the founding president and CEO of Safe Harbor Behavioral Health, which was established to provide intensive outpatient services to patients with serious mental illness and to provide 24-hour-a-day crisis intervention services to anyone in their county.
Dr. Liberty Eberle is the Physician Engagement Director, who's also a licensed psychiatrist and founding partner of Innovatel, and has been providing telepsychiatry since 2010. She's participated in the Compass Grant Program with St. Vincent's Hospital in Pennsylvania, studying the effects of a team approach, including primary care physician, psychiatry, and case manager, with patients experiencing a chronic medical condition and depression. Dr. Eberle is a member of the American Osteopathic Association, having earned her DO degree at Lake Erie College of Osteopathic Medicine and completed her residency at Mill Creek Community Hospital in Pennsylvania. She's also holds a master's in medical education. We are so excited to have both you on the show, and we welcome you both to Answers for the Family.
Thank you very much, Alan. It's John Evans. And we're really honored to be on here and really pleased to participate in the show.
Well, obviously, the statistics don't lie, and mental health needs are growing throughout the country. Is that something you guys are also seeing?
Well, absolutely. And I have to say we're pleased that there's finally beginning to be a lot more open discussion about individuals needing psychiatric care and accessing it. And so we have a lot of big data to share with you just in regards to that. And it's literally actually not just in rural areas, but in urban areas as well. We found that there's a significant shortage of psychiatrists. And Unfortunately, it's not uncommon for individuals when they make that first call to wait anywhere from, you know, from 1 to 3 months for their initial evaluation with a psychiatrist. And we just don't find that's acceptable at all.
You know, in my experience in the like the treatment world, it's similar and on par where, you know, we're lucky at Betty Ford to have a good psychiatrist. But I can't tell you, I get a call each week from another program or another family looking for psychiatry. And it really is unacceptable, these wait times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we try to actually, when we talk about this, when we developed our plan, we try to envision ourselves essentially walking in that individual's shoes. And so if you think about someone who's making a first call to a mental health center or a psychiatrist, and they get to the point where they actually pick up the phone, that family is in crisis, plain and simple. And they need an immediate response to access to care. And not only our experience, but data demonstrates that timely access to care changes the whole course of the outcome in a positive way. Most importantly for that individual seeking care, but for their family and, frankly, for cost of care, is significantly reduced when access is provided in a timely way. And that's what led us to develop telepsychiatry. Our mission is no different than it was in the nonprofit world, in that we are here to provide quick access to care for people where we partner with clinics and provide that coverage.
Now, Dr. Eberle, as the physician engagement director, how are you working with your peers to get them to accept the fact that this is something that can be done, you know, without being in person?
Well, that's a good question, because we are recruiting a lot of physicians who have no experience doing telepsychiatry or have not seen it in their residency. So it is new, and part of what I do is to help keep them engaged with the other InnovaTel employees. So we have regular meetings online where we can see each other via video and also talk on the phone or exchange emails so that our physicians feel supported and connected to one another. For example, on occasion, I like to call a colleague and run a case by them too. So it's important for us to continue to feel like we're a team, since we're not seeing each other in an office from day to day. But also, we like to make sure that our physicians feel part of the team at the clinic that they're working for, and that they have interactions with nursing staff and front desk staff and the therapist, again, becoming an integral part of the team there too.
Now, one of the questions is, so what is some of the data that's indicating the need for telepsychiatry?
Sure. Well, the data is pretty compelling, and when we looked at this to develop this, it really led us in this direction. So the demand for mental health care is growing exponentially, and just some of the things that led to that increasing demand is the systematic closing of state hospitals across the country for budgetary purposes, and frankly, the tools that we have to care for people with serious mental illness are significantly improved. So when we looked at the just one diagnosis, we worked with an actuarial from Penn State, and we said, let's just take the diagnosis of one of the more debilitating diseases, that of schizophrenia, and apply that to what's happening nationally. So that illness, unfortunately, happens at a young age, between 19 and 29. So we asked the actuarial people, how many people in this country turn 20 years old every year? And it's a pretty big number. It's 4 million people. And then if we take the CDC data of the incidence of schizophrenia in that age group, that means between 160 and 175,000 new cases of this very chronic disease are hitting the front doors of community mental health centers every year. So the difficult part of that disease is there is no cure. But the good news, the really positive news is that there is very effective treatment that, once again, if accessed early on in that illness, changes the whole course in a positive way, where a person can live a relatively symptom-free life and be a productive member of the community, versus in the past where they would be relegated to living their life in a state hospital. So that's just one piece of data. Now, on the supply side, on the other hand, the APA, American Psychiatric Association, indicates that over 55% of all practicing psychiatrists in this country are 50 or older. And so they're retiring out at a fairly quick pace, and the residency programs are not filling that pipeline at the other end. So while there's an increase in demand across all sectors, there's a shortage, an increasing shortage of qualified clinicians. So this is such an efficient way, if you can think about it, to get that limited resources into different clinics. And maybe Dr. Everly can talk about how she efficiently moves from clinic to clinic each day when she's working.
Sure. So to give you an example, my office is in my home in Dayton, Ohio, and I am seeing patients in two different clinic populations in the state of Minnesota. So one day I'm in one part of rural Minnesota, and the next day I'm in another part of rural Minnesota, taking care of patients that previously didn't have access to psychiatric care. And so they were being managed, for example, by their primary care physicians, who often don't have a good training background in psychiatry.
Listening to Mr. Evans, I'm concerned about the quality and the quantity of psychiatric residents and people coming into the field. What do you two attribute this kind of shortage to?
Boy, that's a good question. I think the cost of medical school is significant, and I can tell you most of the residents I speak with on average are coming out of the residency programs about a staggering $250,000 in debt. So when medical students look at that debt factor and pick a residency program, you know, they try to make a decision, I think, as much based on the economics as their clinical interest at times. So with that, I do think there are more really talented young people coming into the field of psychiatry, but it's not quite at the rate that we need it. And so there's some other advantages, too, that psychiatric nurse practitioners are a very nice level of mid-level clinicians that can work collaboratively with a psychiatrist to increase access as well. But we have a challenge, and I think one of the efficient ways to get coverage to a lot of people that need care is actually a project that Dr. Everly was involved in that is now coming to forth in regards to integrated care. So the big numbers there are, and these are also quite staggering, is that every day in this country, anywhere from a low of 50% to a high of 65% of every primary care visit is really due to depression or anxiety. And the patient comes in with some type of somatic complaint. And so actually Dr. Everly was involved in a very unique research project that has actually borne some good fruit, where she was doing a consult service with a group of primary care physicians and their team to guide them on the appropriate use of medications. And Dr. Everly, I'm going to defer to you to kind of describe that in a little more detail and how effective it was.
Yeah, I think the other aspect to this, so even though we can bring physicians to rural areas across the country, it still doesn't account for the shortage of psychiatrists. There are still only so many of us with so many working hours in our day. And so one of the solutions is, as John says, to take advantage of collaborative care. And for example, that would be meeting with a family doctor who has several psychiatric patients to review. So we can go through and review perhaps 10 or 12 patients in an hour and talk about what kind of medication changes I would suggest, or dosage changes, or potential interactions that could be occurring, and give feedback to the family doctor, who then goes back and meets with the patient and makes some changes. So we can affect a lot of patients in a short period of time by using collaborative care.
Mm-hmm. And so, Alan, one of the really exciting we're working on a number of projects, actually a couple in Minnesota and one in New York. But one of the really exciting ones is we're working with a rural clinic in New York State, and we have this just wonderful bilingual child psychiatrist who lives in Puerto Rico, and she is seeing patients and children every day in that clinic in New York, where they literally had no access to care prior to this. So it's just such a great way to do this. Now, we have really perfected the quality of the interaction between the physician and the patient over the last 7 years. At this point, it's really quite lifelike. So we've really fine-tuned the technology. So if you can imagine, the patient is actually sitting in a room that's designed for this with a large flat-screen TV mounted on the wall at a specific height, and the person sitting a measured distance from that. So Dr. Everly comes through into the office very lifelike and is literally looking eye-to-eye with the patient. And the satisfaction surveys we get across the board from patients is really quite positive.
Go ahead. And does this include family sessions, or, you know, if there's third parties involved or stakeholders, would a similar experience happen? Mm-hmm.
Dr. Everly, you want to address that one?
Was your question, are other people involved in these sessions?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so sometimes it would be just as if we were having a face-to-face visit. There is no difference with telepsychiatry in that sometimes we do invite family members to attend, case managers, therapists, people who have extra information that could be helpful to us. The same goes with telepsychiatry. Those folks are welcome to come into the room as long as that's what the patient wants.
Now, you just mentioned something that I didn't think of until you brought it up when you mentioned about locating a particular psychiatrist from Puerto Rico that speaks the language. I think that opens up a whole other aspect of this to where, you know, in America here, obviously, we're a melting pot. We speak a lot of different languages. So if I understand you correctly, you have the ability to reach out to get someone that speaks that language, and they may be in another state, another country, whomever it is that happens to be a good fit for that person.
Correct. Right now it's within the United States. There are some specific DEA rules that will not allow us to have physicians coming in from overseas because of some of the prohibitions in regards to prescribing and as they relate to the opioid epidemic. But we're actually working with the DEA to talk about those rules and how we might be able to actually modify them but still hold a very high standard of care. And I guess I'd like to emphasize what Dr. Everly just mentioned is that our model is that there is essentially no difference in the quality and the treatment with telepsychiatry versus the traditional model, with the only exception that they're seeing their physician again on a large screen TV. So the workflow, the documentation, the attention to detail clinically is exactly the same. Again, with the exception of we're having a live encrypted link between the patient and the psychiatrist. So we're really quite vigilant about maintaining a high standard of care.
I mean, it sounds great, and it sounds like the outcomes are going to obviously show exactly what you're saying. I have a question, though, just, and excuse my ignorance. Certain drugs are scheduled, I understand, with different levels. And I was told, you know, for instance, on a stimulant like an Adderall or something, that you have to actually physically be with the patient to provide them a script. How does something like that work at one of these clinics?
That's a good question and a complicated one. So you're probably aware of the Reinhart Act, which was an act passed by Congress following a very tragic situation where a young man used his parents' credit card and ordered some illicit medications over the internet and died as a result of taking those medicines. So it was a tragic situation and one that we certainly want to make sure doesn't happen again. So according to the Act, there are certain criteria that need to be met in regards to prescribing what are called Schedule II drugs, which stimulants are one of those, of course, as well as opioids and some anti-anxiety medications are also Schedule IIs. So depending on the state's interpretation of that Act, really guides whether or not there needs to be a in-person evaluation prior to implementing telepsychiatry. So we are focusing on the states where that is allowed. I did have the opportunity to actually co-present with a member of the DEA last week at a conference, and we talked about the DEA's need to write special rules for clinics so they can get special designations to go ahead and have our psychiatrists prescribe these medications. But with that said, I think it's important to say we are very equally concerned about the significant opioid and addictions crisis in this country, and the last thing I want to do is add to that. So once again, we really maintain extremely high standards in regards to how we go about prescribing. Dr. Everly, you have anything to add to that?
Well, I agree. And I think for the states where we are allowed to prescribe Schedule II substances, what that looks like is we are using the clinic's electronic medical record to prescribe that medication, again, just as if we were in the office face-to-face and would be sending a prescription electronically. So that is the same. I'm able to send that electronically, for example, from Ohio directly to Minnesota and have that prescription arrive at the patient's pharmacy within a half hour or so.
Now, when you're referring to the fact that you're looking at them, are you using a system such as Skype or Zoom? And if so, how are you dealing with the encryption? Is it something that's set up on your end, or are you using an encryption provided by a service like that?
We actually pay for a special service. That's a great question, to make sure the encryption is placed. So we're, again, being very careful. We provide that as part of our service to the clinic, that so we can be ensure it's HIPAA compliant, fully encrypted. And we do frequent testing of that. So it's another really good question. We also, for our psychiatrists that work for us, we actually require them to use our computers. So we have the computers especially built by our IT director, and he puts extra security built into the machine as well. So we're really quite careful about that to ensure, you know, that there's no breach.
This, to me, this is so cool, because the opportunities just keep expanding in my brain as you're talking. And when I worked with a lot of the managed care companies, we ran into some issues with some what we call geographic hardship. So a patient would come to a program, we'd want to step them down, and we'd have difficulty stepping them down into some of these rural or even urban areas because of lack of psychiatric care in these areas. Do you foresee yourself going even beyond the clinic situation to when they step down and staying with the client in the future?
You know, in regards to maybe seeing patients in their homes?
Yeah.
You know, there has been a lot of interest in that. I think the challenge right now are there's a couple in regards to assuring the appropriate level of clinical care. So yeah, I'm sure you're aware that, you know, that there's an importance to have a really robust set of vitals on the chart each visit to kind of track those to make sure that the side effects of the medication aren't, you know, causing any undue problems. So it's a little difficult to get those vitals on the chart, but I'm sure there's going to be a solution coming forward soon. And then, of course, anytime you're working in behavioral health, one has to be prepared to move to a higher level of care very quickly, depending, you know, on an individual patient's level of crisis on that day. So just having those safeguards in place in the home is something where we need to, I think, refine a little better. However, there's such a need. If you think about all the primary care settings, the community mental health centers, and I know, sadly, there in California, one of the largest inpatient psychiatric hospitals in this country is the L.A. County Jail. And we would love to be able to provide telepsychiatry support to the county jails where people with serious illness, for one reason or another, get caught up in the criminal justice system. But, you know, the care they get there may not be at the standard just because there aren't enough physicians that will go into jails. And then the other big area is just in regards to nursing homes and the growing population there and the significant level of depression and comorbid medical illness. So there are so many areas where we think we can be of help in an extremely efficient manner. I think Dr. Everly gave you the example that she, from day to day, moves from one clinic to another. We actually have some physicians that will work in one rural clinic in one state in the morning, and then with the movement of a mouse, be in another rural clinic in a completely different state. So it's an extremely efficient way to get care to people or they wouldn't get it otherwise.
Well, this is a very interesting subject. I want everybody to stay with us. The topic is telepsychiatry. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services and Westshield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
Welcome back to Answers for the Family. We are joined by Jonathan Evans and Dr. Liberty Eberle, the company Innovatel for telepsychiatry we're discussing. And one of the things I took from the first half of our discussion, which really blew me away and was very exciting, was this idea that you guys had to not just throw telepsychiatry out there, but do it in a way that's ethical, do it in a way that's right, where you can look at vitals, where you can work with a team approach. And I know you've both done research with Compass and other things, looking at ways of integrating other stakeholders. And then you also mentioned reaching out and getting involved in prisons and other populations that really struggle at kind of staying at the good standard of what we're looking for in the mental health field. What led to this desire to kind of get into some of these other levels of care, including the prison population?
Well, we were fortunate recently in recruiting one of the top forensic psychiatrists in the East, and she has dedicated, the full 10 years of her career to working with individuals in the prison system that have serious illness and have been incarcerated for one reason or another. And, you know, her frustration has been just a lack of numbers of clinicians that want to do that, and then kind of robust follow-up programs after release so they don't reoffend and have to go back in. So there are a number of advantages to providing telepsych in the corrections system. One is the shortage, of course, but the other is, of course, moving people throughout a prison to be seen is always a security concern for wardens and staff. And this is a method where, again, you can provide the care very efficiently and at the same high level of care without having to move people from pod to pod and you know, take up a lot of staff time. And once again, you can, of course, move a physician from facility to facility with very little effort and just move it through with the use of a mouse. So we're really excited about that, and we really, you can imagine that for whatever reason a person gets involved in the criminal justice system, but that's not a good environment for them to recover from their illness. So the sooner we can get them good care and support that prison population, get them out, the better.
You know, I mean, with what we're talking about, we're really talking about something that looks like a win-win situation. It increases access. It has the potential to improve outcomes, reduces cost. What are some of the roadblocks that you've run into, and where did they come from?
Well, Dr. Everly, you want to start with the physicians, and then I'll talk more about the political end.
Yeah, I think probably most of the roadblocks have come more on the regulation end. There aren't many differences as a physician or as a patient in doing telepsychiatry versus seeing someone face-to-face, because again, we're trying to replicate that experience and be identical to what it would be like for a patient to walk into an office and see their physician live. So, you know, I've been doing telepsychiatry for full time now for 7 years. And occasionally, you know, early on, we had some issues come up with the actual communication, with the getting the speaker just right and the microphone just right and the camera just right. So all of those bugs have been ironed out now many years ago so that it's running seamlessly. But I think really the regulations have been what have held us up, John.
It is, and it's not a untypical, I'm sure you know, Alan, in medicine, is that that you know that technology and advances in science tend to move a lot quicker at times than the regulations can keep up with it, and that's true in our field too. So there, I think the biggest hurdles regulatorily are, as I mentioned before, the Ryan Hyde Act and the interpretation of that act. The acceptance of telemedicine across the board, telepsychiatry. There's also, I'm sure you're aware, is each state has its own licensing requirements, which is understandable. However, it's essentially the same process in each state. And I can tell you it takes us anywhere from 4 to 6 months to get one of our physicians licensed in a new state. When they're fully capable and ready to offer care, and we have patients waiting to be seen. So we're actually, this is a little bit delicate issue, but we're actually advocating for a national standard for licensing, where, you know, states could all agree to that. There's something called the Interstate Compact that's being advocated for, where states agree to a very high level of requirements, which we agree to. And then once a physician is licensed, that can be accepted, you know, as a standard for licensing. And in fact, while most physicians practice at a very high standard of care, there are a few that don't. And this would also give everybody the ability to track those that practice outside the standards of care, so they can't go from state to state and not be tracked well. So, and then third, I think, is just the acceptance of payers to pay for telemedicine. I think they've been a little slow to adopt it, although to be fair, they're coming around, and we would just like to encourage that. So those would be the three large regulatory issues that I think slow things down to some degree.
Yeah, you opened up a whole interesting conversation point with the payers, which I would love to get into a little bit later. But as far as this national standard for licensing, and, you know, we don't normally talk politics on the show, which is a nice break from the reality of most things in this world. But is this the next big thing for you guys in the field of psychiatry? What are some of the things kind of politically going on that we should be keeping our eyes on?
I think for us the big thing is the kind of review of the Ryan Hyde Act and its effect on prescribing. Again, it does limit our ability to prescribe in some areas for a physician to really practice at the standard of care. So I can share with you that we actually had an informal meeting at the American Psychiatric Association with the other major telepsychiatry companies, and you know we're essentially friendly competitors because we all have enough to do, and we committed to, you know, developing or enhancing, I would say, the standards of care for telepsychiatry that we would all sign off on and adhere to and publish, saying that we absolutely commit to these extremely high standards, and quite frankly they are going to be very high, and look to partner with both the federal, state, and local governments and payers to say, with this standard of care, we really feel we can improve access and improve outcomes. And it gives us the opportunity to hit that, what everybody talks about, and I'm sure where is the AAA in healthcare. And this is one of the few opportunities I would contend is available where we can actually improve access, improve outcomes, and lower costs. So there's really, it's such an exciting opportunity for everybody to come out with a positive outcome here. I just think it's getting everybody to understand that and adhere and kind of sign on.
Do you see, you know, in California we have the Cures program, and for those listeners who don't know what that is, it's a, you know, state program that tracks prescriptions, and this way when we're treating patients we can tell whether they've been prescribed benzos or opioids or anything. Do you guys foresee this becoming a national system?
To me, that would be ideal. I think if you had a national program that tracked prescribing patterns, that would really enhance the ability to kind of cut down on some of this maybe excessive prescribing of opioids and other prescriptions and Schedule IIs. Right now, the DEA requires that a physician have a unique DEA number in each state. So, you know, we have physicians that have two and three different DEA numbers in the states where they're prescribing, and then they also have to have a DEA number in the state where they're sitting physically. So I would think that would make it kind of difficult to track that pattern of that individual physician. So, yeah, I do think a national standard program of tracking physicians and licensing them would enhance our ability to significantly cut down on the inappropriate use of all types of medications.
Yeah, and I think that makes perfect sense. And we've had a lot of things in the news lately of doctors who are being prosecuted for over-prescribing. And, you know, so I think that makes perfect sense if we have something like that. Now, we have a listener question that is coming in. And again, we want to thank those listeners that take the time to send in a question either for themselves or for one of their loved ones. This one reads, my cousin returned from Iraq 2 years ago and has moved to a very rural town in eastern Oregon. He admits to his family that he received a diagnosis of PTSD from the Veterans Administration, but is reluctant to seek help in his tiny community. I spoke to him last week after reading about your services, and he is very open to the services, and I will tell him to listen, and I will also be listening into the show. So I want you to know that we're very grateful for the information provided. And this is from BJ in Oregon. Thank you, BJ. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, now, you know, what I do know about the VA program, and I'm not sure if it's nationwide, but I know there are kind of geographical areas where they do offer individuals with PTSD to actually connect with their therapist in the home for therapy, via even on FaceTime or on their iPad. Now, I'm not sure if that would reach to where this young man is, but if not, there should be hopefully a clinic in his area. I know that Oregon is a good state from a regulatory point of view for telepsychiatry, and to give the VA credit, they have really done their best to try to develop and implement a pretty robust telepsychiatry program. So I would suggest that he may contact his regional VA provider and see if that they would have that available to him, so he doesn't, you know, have to go into a clinic, which I understand for some people is uncomfortable.
And Dr. Eberle, do you have anything to add to that listener's question?
Well, I agree. I agree with John. It sounds like reaching out to the VA is a good first step. I think it's unfortunate that we have people and families like this who just don't have access to care. I hate to think of someone sitting at home suffering from PTSD and feeling like they have no resources. So, you know, while Innovatel is not currently in the state of Oregon, we hope to continue to grow and spread our wings and see the other, you know, telepsychiatry companies do that as well, so that everyone can have access to care. I see patients, like I said, in Minnesota, and they're still having to drive sometimes an hour or an hour and a half just for a medication management appointment with me to come into the clinic. So even though we've gone to rural areas, this patches of people who still aren't anywhere near care is way too large.
And it's interesting, you know, we talk about urban and rural, and I had a meeting at Magellan in San Diego, which is a managed care provider out here in California, actually nationwide. And the meeting was for something else, but during the conversation, telepsychiatry came up, and they're doing all kinds of really cool outcome studies and pilots, and, you know, they're kind of on board from the feeling I got and the stuff that they were doing. Are you seeing, and I know, Mr. Evans, you mentioned that they're starting to come on board some of the national, you know, managed care companies. Are you guys seeing, and, oh, I'm sorry. One of the things that she mentioned in that meeting was, I said, oh, it's great for their people in, you know, in rural areas. And she says, no, no, it's the people in urban areas that are using it just as much. So you guys are seeing similar stuff I heard you mention earlier.
We are, and I do think it is a bit of a myth that there are more than enough psychiatrists in the urban areas. And I can tell you, I had an experience some months ago where I was at a fairly busy public hospital in the middle of Manhattan who does not have enough psychiatric coverage. And the dynamic in some large cities that I've visited is that the shortage is so significant that private psychiatrists in those larger cities have become frustrated enough with dealing with different payers that they've gone to a cash-only practice, and they are quite full that way. And so then the dynamic of that is that even though there seem to be on, you know, listed enough psychiatrists per 100,000 individuals according to government standards, they aren't available for the public system. And so I would contend that this shortage is everywhere in every sector. It just happens to be significantly more pronounced in the rural areas. And I think Dr. Everly talked about, you know, the distance that some of her patients have to drive. There's some data out there that there are a majority of the counties in rural America that have literally no licensed clinician practicing in that county. And so she's correct that patients, even with some of our work, have to drive any hours just one way to see a physician. So if we can really expand this modality more through all of the providers that do this, this will really help a lot of people both in the rural and urban communities.
I couldn't agree more. And it's even, we're here in West LA, and if you're not willing to be a cash pay patient, you are going to wait forever to see a psychiatrist. And so my question to you is, are you seeing, you know, the providers, it sounds like you are starting to see the movement with the providers getting on board with this?
Yes, and our organization's commitment is really fundamentally to work with community mental health centers and primary care practices. So that's where we've worked our entire career. It is unquestionably our mission. And to that end, we actually have a strategic partnership with the National Council on Community Behavioral Health Care, and Linda Rosenberg is their president. She's done an outstanding job, as you probably know, of talking nationally about the need for mental health. She brought the Mental Health First Aid program to this country, which is a tremendous program to train individuals to recognize symptoms. And so our commitment is to work with those public clinics to enhance access to care. And we hope to be able to do that and expand to more states as both the regulations and others support that.
And Dr. Eberle, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I just think, too, it goes back to the collaborative care, too. And we need a good model for family doctors to be able to collaborate with a psychiatrist, even if it's just for an hour of time a week, where, again, they can review several cases all at once and get some feedback and help their patients already in their local area. I think that would provide a lot of care for a lot of patients without having to utilize as much time. For example, I'm scheduled to see three patients an hour. So that's not very many. When you think about, I have to, you know, how much time it takes to visit with a patient and come up with a treatment plan versus doing a case review with a family doctor where we can review perhaps 12 patients in an hour. So I think there really needs to be a push in that direction for that to start happening at the level of the primary care office.
Well, we have a comment that's coming in. This is coming in from a fellow professional. This one reads, as a professional in the field, I just wanted to say how much I enjoy having joined the remote treatment community. At first, I thought my clients would be less open if they were not sitting right in front of me in my office. I was totally wrong about this. Many that were quiet and shy have become the most talkative and expressive when they're speaking from home. Over the phone has made them so much more relaxed. For anyone who wonders if this really is a good option, I have to say it is now my preference as well as many of my clients. And this is from Dr. Gordon L. in Pennsylvania.
That's just a great feedback. And, you know, Dr. Everly, I think you've noticed some enhancements too in your experience, have you not?
Yes, I love that comment too, because I think that's so true. I see patients who are trying this for the first time every single week where they're coming back with the nurse and they're saying to me, oh, this is strange, or it feels awkward, or I'm not sure I'm going to like this. And they sit down and we start talking. And that part is just the same as if we were seeing each other face to face, and you notice that the person is starting to relax and they're starting to engage and they're starting to open up. And by the end of the visit, they're saying, oh, this was just fine. I was so nervous about nothing. And so absolutely, I think that once people try it and get over that first hurdle of imagining what it would be like, people are saying that it feels the same. And I've had many kids too. I see a lot of kids and families who come in and just think it's the coolest thing ever to be able to see their physician on a TV screen and go home and tell their families that they saw their doctor on TV and talk to their doctor on TV. And I think anxious people too, sometimes for them, I have had them say to me, this feels better actually than sitting face to face with someone, that this takes away a little bit of the anxiety and helped me to relax and warm up.
Yeah, I know that there have been many programs over the last maybe 10 years that have set up situations where young people have gone to a particular program out of state, and they set up teleconference as a way for the psychiatrist that's at the program to be able to talk with the parents and with the teen at the same time. And so I saw this, you know, some years ago, and I'm so glad that you guys have taken it and really grown it into something that can be so beneficial to so many people. Now, anybody that has listened to this show knows that one of my favorite things are the success stories. We've only got about 2 minutes. If you could share maybe your favorite success story, we would appreciate it.
Dr. Everly, I'm going to let you take that one.
Oh, gosh, I know. That's a tricky question. I don't know that I have any one particular story, John, but I think about at the time when I started doing telepsychiatry 7 years ago, and I was faced with potentially having to leave the clinic I was working for. I had, about 550 patients there at the time. And the option one was to leave that clinic so that I could move back to my hometown of Dayton, Ohio, and find a job working for a clinic here, or be able to continue to serve those 550 patients by doing telepsychiatry. So I think there is a success story. I was able to move home to my hometown, continue serving all of those patients for many years, whereas otherwise they would have been forced to start all over with a new psychiatrist, find a new doctor, likely even have to leave the facility that they were attending for years to try to find a new doctor. So there's a story right there where we helped 550 patients just by being able to do telepsychiatry.
I think that's phenomenal.
And that was actually our impetus for starting the company, was Dr. Everly's, I think, kind of paving the way for us. And maybe one other story real quickly I can tell you is we have a tremendous child psychiatrist in Louisville, Kentucky, Dr. McCray Ashby, and he had a private practice that was very busy, and he just tried this out with us a little bit, and he liked it so much that he decided to do this full time. And I asked him why, and he said, listen, I got into this to see children, and I recognize I can see a lot more children this way. And the other really exciting part about that is he works from his home office, and one time his cat jumped up on his lap while he was working, and the kids he was seeing just liked it so much that the cat now has become a kind of a part of some of his visits, and the children look as much forward to seeing his pet cat as he does his. And so it's just another engagement tool that you might not have in a traditional model.
That is a I could visualize that cat right now in that story. You know, what a great way to end a great conversation. The company, obviously, Innovatel, is a great company, and we are so thankful that Jonathan Evans and Dr. Liberty Everly were able to join us. So thank you guys for coming on the show.
Listen, very honored to be part of this. We really appreciate the work you do as well.
All right. And keep us posted on things that are changing as you learn more. If you have some things that are going on where you're taking things from statewide to federal, let us know. We would love to know more about it, and we would love to know what we can do to help.
Well, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Right. Thanks, Dr.
Thank
Everly.
You.
And please be sure to put us on your calendar and tune in next Monday, June 12th, when we are joined by Bailey Gaddis, author of Feng Shui Mommy, Creating Balance and Harmony for Blissful Pregnancy, Childbirth, and Motherhood.
And if you missed or want to share our show with your friends, please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com. And you may also subscribe or resubmit your name to download your free copy of the Attitude of Gratitude Journal, your 21-day guide to achieving the quality of thankfulness through self-discovery.
And the next time you're on Facebook and Twitter, please remember to stop by our page and let us know what you think.
Be good human beings and be with us next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.